I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, we have a discussion about the wind farm industry potentially expanding in New London. Martha Shanahan stops by to talk about ticks and tick-borne pathogens, and Erica Moser gives us a recap of last week's Coast Guard Academy graduation. Columnist David Collins and editorial page editor Paul Schwanier are back in the studio with me to debate the pros and cons of the state's recently announced $15 million investment at State Pier in New London, which is to be used for infrastructure improvements and to prepare the pier for future use by the region's growing offshore wind industry. While Paul and the Day's editorial board see it as a great opportunity for growth in New London, David isn't so sure. Here's David.
I have to say, I'm all for wind power and offshore wind power, and I think the Block Island project was a great first start, and I'm encouraged that Connecticut is going to buy wind power and has committed to this. However, Governor Malloy's decision to invest $15 million in State Pier after this is already kind of developed and the wind developers have already looked at New London and started to bid and seek to make their own improvements to the State Pier seemed once again completely unnecessary for something that's already going to happen.
Yeah, I disagree in that. I think this kind of investment in a state pier is exactly the sort of thing that the state should be using its bonding money for. I know the state has been criticized, including by David, for some of the private partnerships that they formed in using state money to incentivize private development. But this, you know, this is putting infrastructure, you know, into a public facility. It should be intended to help grow this new endeavor that we hope New London will see, which is services and supplying the construction of the wind farms offshore. So I think you have to look sort of hard to see a dark cloud in this silver lining. I think it's good for New London and it's good for the state, and I think it'll have positive economic ramifications for New London, for the area generally.
Right. I don't.
Yeah. So I was just going to ask. Dave, your complaint is it the amount of money that's being
No, it's just the fact that this money is being thrown around once again when it's not necessary. And I mean, offshore wind is great, and I think even though it's not going to be as good for New London as some people seem to think it is, because there's no property tax being paid to the city. So once again, the city is hosting this sort of non-tax-paying entity providing services. So that's unfortunate, and that's, what Governor Malloy should have focused on, when the fact that these wind companies are going to come and really want to use New London, that he should have provided some other way for New London to be compensated. And instead, he's compensating these big, rich companies. The one, Deepwater Wind, is run by the giant hedge fund in New York City. They're going to be able to sell their electricity at rates higher than other conventional sources of electricity. And the timing of it was so strange. I mean, they already want to come to New London. I think of it as sort of, if you have your house on the market and you've gotten some bids and people are interested and the realtor says, hey, we're doing really well, I've got these contracts and they're competing, and then all of a sudden you say to the realtor, hey, how about we put a new swimming pool out back? Well, you don't need to at that point. They're already coming to you and they're bidding and they want to spend money on the pier. So the timing of it was just very strange. Not that, you know, in general, the state improving the pier and trying to work for a busier port is all great, but the timing of this is so odd. They're just about to release these contracts in which these wind companies are going to buy electricity from Connecticut, and they want to build these farms here from New London.
How about that, Paul? Is it that, do you think it's such a foregone conclusion that these projects are coming to the area anyway, that the incentive isn't needed?
No, I don't think that's the case. The assumption is that New London will be one of the ports that will be utilized in servicing the constructions of these wind farms, and it goes well beyond the contracts that Connecticut is bidding. You see the construction and leasing of these potential wind farms up and down the eastern seaboard. And I don't think Connecticut or New London could assume that they'll get a fair proportion of that business. So I think it's a good investment by the state to improve those facilities. You know, and as for the, you know, the fact that it is state property, which is not taxable, but there'll be equipment utilized by these private companies that will be located on that property, and that personal property will be subject to taxation. There's also some private land that's zoned industrial adjacent to the state pier, which if this thing gets humming, as we hope it will, that property could well be developed, and that would be subject to taxation. So, I think it's a case of sort of finding money on the ground for New London and, you know, complaining that it's littering. I mean, it's this is sort of good news that the state is investing here in New London. And again, I think you kind of have to look kind of hard to see any negative spin on this. I think it will be good for the city. I think it'll produce jobs and to some extent it'll produce more revenue for New London.
One of the bidders for the Connecticut contracts, Deepwater Wind, says that they would invest $15 million in State Pier. Others have indicated, apparently, we know from the Port Authority, their interest in even bidding on the rights to run the pier. So there's clearly an enormous amount of interest, and we know less about what their interests are and what they plan to do than the governor who announced this money. And as for New London, it's not bad. Certainly it's not bad. I mean, it's not like I'm suggesting that this is sort of this terrible thing that's coming to New London. I think it's very exciting. It's a new industry, and there may be growth from it, not necessarily in New London, though. And it's going to, you know, from the governor's perspective, it's going to hire, you know, bring more jobs, and it's all great. But from the city's perspective, I rack my brain. I see really no benefit, especially. Again, no harm, but no benefit, really. Whatever they might be able to tax some crane on how much is that? And there's going to be more traffic. There's these big things that are going to be brought into the city through the city streets and the highways. And it's certainly are there going to be calls for police services and fire services. And, you know, some of these workers, a lot of the jobs are going to go to people outside the city. I mean, maybe some city residents will get jobs, hopefully, but a lot of them are going to be people commuting from outside. And they're going to bring some commerce to downtown or to the pier area. They'll buy lunch, they'll bring some put some money into the economy, and all that's good, but it's not great. It's nothing transforming for New London. And I think it's disappointing that this governor has been focusing on what to do here to help and to kind of move it along, is choosing to help these companies run by giant hedge funds instead of the poor city of New London.
So do you think there was anything for the mayor to do to ensure that the projects came to New London?
I sort of blame, again, the mayor is positive about this. It's a positive thing. It's not negative, but I didn't see anything. I don't know, but it doesn't appear that the mayor or the state representatives, Chris Soto was at this announcement at State Pier, and so was Senator Formica from East Lyme. Shouldn't they have been pushing the governor further to do something else for the city, to mitigate this for the city, to bring some relief? I mean, this is a constant dialogue about the fact that the city has no property tax base. And here's a perfect example of this great new industry that's booming and coming to New London, and New London really gets very little from it.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to disagree on that. I think New London potentially get quite a lot of it. You know, as I noted earlier, there's other property zone industrial surrounding the pier. We've always complained for years that it seems to be that the state pier is underutilized. And here we have an opportunity to finally see it better utilized. And that's why I think it's a smart investment for the state to make. I would like to see some job training programs so some of the people in New London do get some of those jobs. One of the bidders for this wind farm project, has talked about a host city agreement, and would like to see some training programs included in that, something that we would like to see. But I think it's exciting. It's good for New London. We know they're repairing the rail. The services New London, the heavy freight rail, is being improved. So I think it's a step forward of more commerce, you know, at the pier, and that's good for the city and it's good for the region generally.
I wish I could sing, because I maybe would weigh in here with wishing and hoping a little bit, because I'm not sure that the sense that they're going to start building these components that they're only now planning to assemble will ever happen. And if it does, if it'll actually happen immediately adjacent to the pier, maybe it does. Maybe it'll be great. Maybe it'll go on private land. Maybe this is the great turning of the corner for New London. I don't see that on the table right now.
With the increased investment by the state, is there potential, and you mentioned kind of the infrastructure, the problems with infrastructure and traffic, is there any, you think, Paul, any possibility that might perhaps bring some extra spending in our region for infrastructure, for 95, for improving some of that based on the potential of this industry coming to this region?
From my understanding, a lot of this will be serviced by the waterways. So coming into the pier, it's a deep water port.
Right, right.
So I don't think that'll put much taxing on the infrastructure. But in a way, those are good problems to have. I mean, if you have more commerce, if you're generating economic activity, things have to be adjusted to meet that. But you know, God forbid we have that problem. That's not the problem we've had in the state. We've had years of lacking said economic progress. So I'll choose to be optimistic about this. And, you know, time will tell whether the amount of activity it generates and whether the investment pays off or not.
Thank you both.
Thanks.
There are about 1,000 unsolved murders in Connecticut.
It's always stayed with me, right on through all the different ranks that I held in the police department.
Case Unsolved, a new podcast from the newsroom at The Day, tells the stories of unsolved murders in Connecticut and the family, friends, and law enforcement left without resolution.
And our department really wanted to solve this.
Listen at caseunsolvedpodcast.com or your favorite podcast app.
Martha, talk to me about ticks and tick-borne diseases.
Yeah, so I wanted to write about this because it seemed like there was some anecdotal evidence, I guess, that this was a sort of a quote-unquote bad year for ticks. What I got from talking to the entomologist from the state and some other public health sort of Lyme disease experts, it's basically we live in Connecticut, so every year is a bad tick year. Their population has been increasing over the years. And something interesting that I learned is that at one point the tick problem almost entirely went away during sort of colonial times in Connecticut, while the farms were expanding and basically most of Connecticut was being deforested, which was killing off a lot of the deer, or the deer populations went down to below 100 in the state at one point. And that almost sort of eradicated ticks from Connecticut. But as we moved away from farming and the forests grew back, so the deers came back and now we have more ticks than ever. And they've sort of spread out. So they're in more parts of the state than they were. They used to be concentrated in certain parts of the state, in Lyme, for right. example, where the first, you know, cases of Lyme disease were identified. So they've kind of spread out. And in addition, the CDC recently put out a report basically saying that there are more diseases that are becoming more tick-borne diseases that are becoming more common across the country. And that also applies to Connecticut. So Lyme disease is the one that people are most aware of. And a lot of the, I think it's 30% of the ticks that get sent to the state lab where they test for Lyme disease. About 30% of those ticks get tested for Lyme or test positive for Lyme. And then a smaller percent of them test for other diseases. For example, babesiosis, which is a fairly serious other kind of tick-borne right. disease that's not related to Lyme at all.
Have there been fatalities?
Yeah, it can be fatal. I think somebody in Connecticut died of it last year.
Right.
And there are other diseases that ticks can carry as well. And the other scary thing is that ticks can carry multiple diseases. So it's all great and fine. And the sort of gist of the story is that there are efforts in place to try to reduce the number of deer that are carrying ticks, and you know, you can spray your lawn, and right. and there are some efforts sort of out there there's the tick boxes. And there's also would that sort of, I don't know, attract the ticks and kills them. But, and then there's also something, there's a device that's installed in certain places, including on Mason's Island, where, it's sort of a feeding station for deer.
Mm-hmm.
Where the deer come up and you put corn there that attracts the deer, and when the deer sticks its head into it to eat the corn, right. it gets rolled on the neck with paint rollers that are coated with anti-tick chemical, that keeps ticks off the deer.
Wow.
For the most part. But anyway, so the gist is that, you know, all these things are in place, and hypothetically they might be making some effect on the tick population, but really for the time being, it's really up to people to
check themselves
and do things like wear long pants, use bug spray. I talked to the manager of a landscaping company who told me that they're very busy, especially right. this time of year, with people, and they're getting a lot of new customers. And he said over the past 5 or 6 years, it's really become more of a popular service that they right. provide, and it's sort of increased with the number of ticks that people are seeing in their yards.
And you looked at the data from the state mm-hmm. Department of Health, and did you notice any?
Yeah, so
any
the
trends?
Along with the tick population, the reported Lyme disease numbers sort of fluctuate from year to year. They did go up between 2016 and 2017 across Connecticut and in New London County. And New London County tends to be one of the highest, one of the counties with the highest rates of, I think they measure it per 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And New London County is up there around upper 90s, which is around the third highest. I think in both years it was the third highest in the state. So part of it is just sort of the number of ticks. It sort of also just depends on who, like how many cases get reported.
Right.
And I think in this part of the state, because we are in the place where Lyme disease was invented. Yeah. people are generally more aware of it, so they might be reporting it more. One of the difficulties with Lyme disease is that an official report of Lyme disease requires that, you know, a person, you know, test positive for it, and also that the tick be officially sort of
identified
right. and test positive for Lyme as well. So, and that doesn't always happen. Sometimes people just go in and they get treated, and that doesn't necessarily get reported to the
right, because they recommend you, if you find a tick, you remove the tick, you put it in like a little Ziploc, mm-hmm. and then take it to the doctor for testing.
Yeah, so that's not always possible, or sometimes, you know, people don't still have the tick on them when they go in to get treated.
All right. Thank you. So May 23rd, you got to spend some time at the Coast Guard Academy for the graduation.
Yes, Wednesday, May 23rd was the 137th commencement exercises for the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. This year, the speaker was Vice President Mike Pence. Last year, it was President Donald Trump. Right. Fun fact, just personally, the commencement last year was the day of my job interview for the day.
Right.
I think the editors may have forgotten the timing there. So yeah. They had me in, and all of the reporters were out dispatched for the commencement.
Yeah, last year, it was a little bit more involved last year because Trump had just gotten elected and he was here. So there was an expected number of protesters. So yeah, our coverage was a little bit wider last year because we had people, I think we had two reporters outside covering the protesters and counter-protesters. Yeah, not so much this year.
Not so much this year. We did have reporter Greg Smith, who covers New London, went to one of the smaller protests, but I got the sense it wasn't on the scale as last year. So this was my first Coast Guard Academy graduation to be covering. And it's interesting with events like this. I actually, at my last job, did cover an event where then-Vice President Joe Biden was speaking. And you find that when you have such high-profile people at events, there's such intense security measures. So even though the commencement ceremony was beginning at 11, reporters have to be there between 9:30 and or 7:30 and 9:30. Right. And that's just if you don't have equipment. Whereas our videographer, right. Tim Cook, who has two young children, so... Bless him. He was setting up his camera at, I think, 3:37 in the morning. It had to be set up by 4.
And it was kind of, was it drizzling or raining, actually raining at that point?
I think it was raining a little bit, but I can't tell you. I was asleep, luckily for me.
Deep asleep.
So I covered the ceremony with Julia Bergman, who's our military and defense reporter. So she is seasoned in this, has done this before. So Julia drove... The two of us over to the armory lot where for media parking. So we got there maybe a little after 8:30, and then there's shuttle buses that were taking us from there to the Coast Guard Academy, to the field. And so we probably got there about 9 o'clock, and we had split up our roles a bit so that Julie was going to be more focused on the vice president's speech, and I was going to be getting what we call color, which is just observing and talking to people and getting stories from the people there. So we got there around 9 and, you know, had to get our credentials and all that and go through metal detectors. Beautiful day for it. Unfortunately, I didn't reapply sunscreen, so I have some rather pink arms right now.
Yeah. Did you have sunglasses, a hat, anything to protect you?
I don't have sunglasses because I have this terrible habit of destroying all of the sunglasses I own through breaking them or losing them. This one's just super scratched. I can't see out of them. Anyway, so it was a beautiful day. So I got there and was just wandering around the stands and talking to some families about, you know, their feelings on their family member graduating and what they're doing after they graduate, hearing about what cutter they're going to be on. What really struck me was how many people I talked to were saying that the cadet who was graduating had many family members who are serving or have served in the armed forces. People talking about saying, oh, his grandfather was in the Marines and his father was in the Navy, stuff like that. So I think it really runs in the family and there's a lot of pride. And you can tell that when people grow up with it, it really has an impact on them, and that helps inform their decision. After the ceremony, I ended up speaking with Jacqueline Cocomore, who is a 2014 Fitch High School graduate. So there were 8 Coast Guard Academy graduates out of the 209 graduating who are from Connecticut. Right. So it's always nice to be able to get that local angle. And
any sense how many others from our region in particular, other than Kokomo?
I think there was 2 or 3 others from southeastern Connecticut out of 8 total from Connecticut. Right. So, and Jacqueline Cocomore was talking about how obviously when you're growing up in the area, you see the impact of the Coast Guard Academy.
Was interested in the academy because obviously I'm in the area, but a lot of people had said, like, you know, this is a great opportunity, you need to look into it. And I had a few of my role models go to the Air Force and the Naval Academy. Okay. So it was like a little bit stemmed off of them. And so coming into SWAB summer, I was obviously excited, but it's definitely been an experience. It's like had its up and downs. And I said earlier, like, the 200-week program, you definitely go through and you're like, really, I'm only at week 100? Like, this is halfway and I have to do it all over again? But ultimately, it's so worth it and it was so much fun. And how often do you get the chance to live in the same building with all of your best friends and you know, hang out every day, like through the good and the bad. So.
She had a few friends from the swim team who went to, I think, the Air Force Academy and the Naval Academy. Right. So these were role models to her, so that really influenced her decision. And she's actually she's going to be heading off to the Coast Guard cutter Weishi.
So I was on it this past summer for 5 weeks, and then it's been in dry dock for the last year up in Seattle, so I'll meet the boat up in Seattle just in time to back down to Alameda and get her ready to go back on patrol.
So, of course, it was a big deal for everyone looking over when the motorcade's coming right in, and everyone sees the vice president coming in, and he walks in, and we were at least twice prepared for the 19 cannon salute, but can you ever really be prepared for a 19 cannon salute?
Yeah.
But, you know, you really see a lot of the tradition and the seriousness in ceremonies like this.
I've never been. It's like pageantry.
There's a lot of pageantry. Yeah. A lot of it is solemn, but also just very proud.
Mm-hmm.
And then so the vice president spoke, and he was talking about investments in the military that this administration has made. He brought in a lot of his faith into his speech, and he was also in general talking about what he views as the top characteristics of leaders.
Many people spend their entire lives searching for a calling. You found yours early. You were called to serve the greatest nation on earth. And to your undying credit, you answered the call, coming here to this academy, dedicating your talents, your energy to saving lives, enforcing our nation's laws, and securing our homeland in times of peace and in times of war. You know, I can tell you, today when your loved ones fix those bars on your shoulders, it'll be one of the proudest days of their lives. And I know what I'm talking about. You know, other than my wedding day, I count the day that Karen and I fixed the bars on our son's shoulders as one of the proudest days of our lives. It truly was. You know, today is a proud and deeply moving moment for your loved ones. They believed in you, even when you didn't. They supported you. They encouraged you to work hard to get here. And in many cases, they prayed you through the last 4 years.
And then I'd mentioned that there were eight Connecticut residents who were graduating. And then there was also another six from other countries. So that's Bahamas, Gabon, Honduras, Mexico, Thailand, and Panama. And then aside from Vice President Pence, another speaker was... Dylan Gregory Teschumper, who was the distinguished graduate. So he gave a speech, and he was talking about being on a 270-foot cutter in Key West, and an alarm sounded. He found out that a return fuel line had ruptured. And he thought, you know, how am I in any way prepared to deal with this? And then he thought, okay, you know, I know how to hold a hose. I know how to do this. He said, no fuel was ignited and there wasn't a crisis. But what struck me was he said, quote, we don't understand how much we truly know and how much the Academy prepared us until it really counts. So that was his story illustrating that. And then, you know, they read through all the names, and for each person, they tell you, you know, the person's name and where they're going to be going in terms of what cutter they're going to be on. So you have these cadets who are now ensigns. That was other terminology I was learning was the distinct moment. I was trying to keep track of the distinct moment when I could stop tweeting about them as cadets and start tweeting about them as ensigns.
And do they get some something that signifies that they're now ensigns, right? Like a board? What is a... No,
I don't know. I was kind of behind the wall and not seeing as much of what was happening. But so these ensigns are now off to cutters like Diligence, Polar Star, Sequoia, Harriet Lane, Reliance, Kimball, Hamilton, and there was a lot of talk about Alexander Hamilton and you know his history with the Coast Guard.
Yeah.
So for each name, you hear where they're going, and then for a bunch of students. The commissioning would come from a family member. I remember one student in particular, Michael William Compton got the commissioning from his mother and father, and his father is Major General and his mother is Brigadier General. Wow. So you could hear in the crowd kind of this, ooh, like this, yeah, this excitement of, oh, wow. But for a lot of other people, they were getting commissioned by their mother, father, brother, grandfather, from people in the Air Force, Army, Navy. So that's really special for them to get that from a family member.
And what's the energy in the stands from like family and friends that are watching this going on? I mean, is there like cheers? I mean, I guess at some point they are respectful of the speakers, but is there like, what's it like in the stands?
You can see, as I mentioned before, a lot of pride and pride in whoever they know who is graduating, and also pride of what they have found at the Coast Guard Academy. And I think the word that came up a few times when I was talking to people in the stands, saying, you know, tell me a bit about your granddaughters or grandsons or sons or daughters or brothers, sisters, whoever it was, experience. Right. I kept hearing the word camaraderie. So you could see that among the cadets sitting there, and you could tell that the people watching really felt that. I think just a lot of respect is the tone, that there's great respect for what is going on. And it was interesting because, you know, they say once they start reading the names, they say, please hold all your applause and cheers until the end. And I'm used to covering all these high school graduations, and nobody cares about that. And at first I was thinking, oh, well, you know, this is a military academy, you know, maybe people will care about this time. And plenty of people did. You still had some families that would cheer anyway.
Right.
The most cheering you got for what I ended up hearing was that it is a tradition at the Coast Guard Academy for the cadets to cheer the loudest for whoever got the lowest grade in the class that they do every year. So I remember being confused because I can hear some family cheering for one person. And then from the other side of me, I hear the cadets cheering. And I'm like, why are the cadets cheering? And then I, you know, heard someone else say that this was their tradition. So
who was it?
Kind of a funny thing.
I don't want to put him
I won't name him. No.
Yeah. You looking forward to it next year?
We'll see. I never know what I'll be assigned to, right, but it was a good experience to be there.
Thank you.